29. Nora woke with a start. She'd been waiting up for Skip on the sofa in their sitting room reading a thriller, and she hadn't intended to fall asleep. But the ridiculous story about the last living Cyclops on Earth hadn't held her attention. She was instantly wide awake. She checked the time, 5 a.m. Had Skip come in quietly? But Mitty would have barked a greeting. She sprang from the sofa. Skip's door was shut, and she knocked. No answer. She opened it to find Skip's room empty, bed made. "Shit!" she said aloud, mind racing. Skip had told her he wouldn't be preparing dinner that evening because he and Baton were going to spend the day trying to locate the watchtower. They had set off early, but Skip wasn't back. What about Baton? She shrugged out of her pajamas and dressed in haste, then flung open the front door. Baton's trailer was nearby, and she ran over and pounded on its door. No answer. Finding the door unlocked, she went inside. The place was a mess, bed unmade and no astronomer. Now she went into full panic mode. Exiting Baton's trailer, she made a beeline for Tappan's RV. Without even bothering to knock, she ran inside and pounded on Tappan's bedroom door. Within moments, he opened it, dressed only in underwear and a t-shirt.
"Back for round two?" he asked,
his smile disappearing as he saw the expression on her face.
"Skip and Gnome are missing," she said breathlessly. "They went out on a hike yesterday and never came back."
"Just a moment."
He pulled on some clothes and they went outside. Tappan cupped his hands and started crying loudly for everyone to get up, while Nora went around knocking on doors. In 5 minutes, a bewildered, sleepy, and tousled group had assembled outside Tappan's RV. Abruptly, the camp lights snapped on, bathing them all in a bright yellow glow.
"We have two missing members," Tappan began,
but suddenly stopped when a bark sounded from the darkness beyond. A moment later, Mitty flew into the light, barking loudly. Nora called out,
"Skip! Skip!"
An unintelligible cry came from the darkness.
"It's him!"
someone cried as a figure staggered into the circle of light. Clothes torn and dusty, hair askew, face scraped, nose bloody. Nora rushed over and grabbed him.
"Skip, are you okay?"
"I'm fine," he cried. "I just slid off a ridge. Listen, Gnome Baton is missing."
"You're bleeding," Nora said as Skip tried to disentangle himself from her.
"I'm telling you, it's just a few scrapes. Please, let me talk."
His voice was hoarse. Nora backed off.
"Could somebody bring me water?" he asked the group. "My throat's all dry."
As someone rushed off to fetch water, he continued.
"We took a day trip to find the Spanish watchtower, and we found it. But we kept going down into the plains and the hills beyond. We separated and were supposed to meet back at a rendezvous point. He never showed. I waited for hours and then tried to come back here, but got lost. My phone went dead. I had a fall, but I'm okay. Just some scraped hands. Smacked my nose, too. I was hoping Mitty might go and get help, but he wouldn't leave me. We've got to go find Baton."
All this came out in a breathless rush, and then Skip greedily took up a glass of water handed to him and drank it down.
"More, please,"
he said, passing it back as a bowl was brought for Mitty. Tappan spoke.
"Skip, I'm a little confused here."
Skip glanced at him. Seeing the sudden guilty expression on her brother's face, Nora's heart sank.
"If your goal was the tower, why did you go so much farther? And why did you separate?"
He paused.
"I think there's something you're not telling us."
A silence descended. Skip glanced at Nora, who, temporarily forgetting her concern for his well-being, glared back.
"I was sworn to secrecy," Skip said at last. "Now's not the time to hold back," Tappan said angrily. "For God's sake, Gnome could be hurt, even dying.
You've got to tell us what you were doing.
Right. Okay.
Yet Skip still hesitated, looking at the assembled group one after the other, gingerly.
Gnome has this theory.
He stopped again.
Go on,
Tappan said. Now Skip took a deep, shaky breath and let the words tumble out in a rush.
He decided this wasn't the crash site after all. He called it a skip site instead, where the UAP bounced after impact and went airborne again, crashing farther away. He figured the location was out on the plains of Atalaya, or the hills beyond. That's what we were searching for. The real crash site. And where exactly does he think this site is?
Tappan asked, voice edged with exasperation. Skip reached into his backpack and pulled out a rumpled piece of paper.
Here's a map he drew. The area we were searching is outlined in red pencil.
Tappan snatched it and stared.
What the hell were you two thinking, keeping this secret? It was his secret. It wasn't mine to betray.
Skip hung his head.
He said he wanted to find it himself. Then he would tell you.
Nora felt awful. Skip had managed to screw up again. She could see Tappan was beside himself, but controlling it well.
Okay. All right. We'll address that later. Skip, can we reach this area by jeep? Yes. You drive across the mesa top to the watchtower, and there's a way down. We marked the watchtower on the map with GPS coordinates.
Skip paused.
There's something else, though. On my way back, once I'd given up waiting, I saw some lights in those hills. I don't know if it was Dr. Baton or somebody else. Lights?
Tappan was silent a moment. Then he turned to the group.
Here's what we're going to do. We'll outfit three jeeps with water, food, and first aid, and head out at first light. That's only an hour from now. We're going to search the entire area marked on this map. Understood?
He issued some more rapid, specific orders. Then he turned to Nora.
You stay here with Skip and get him cleaned up and bandaged. We're taking walkie-talkies, and we'll be in contact in case we have questions for him. Skip looks worse than he's letting on. And after you've taken care of your brother, I want you to get on the sat phone to that FBI contact of yours, report a missing person, and ask her how we should proceed.
Right. He laid a gentle hand on her shoulder.
Thank you, Nora.
He turned.
Okay, everyone. Let's get these jeeps loaded, gassed, and ready to roll.
30.
I'm fine.
Skip said irritably as Nora tried to wipe his bloody nose with a damp cloth. It didn't look broken, but it was pretty scraped up. His palms were also skinned, a fingernail torn, and there was a bad abrasion on one knee. Mitty lay on his bed, utterly wiped out.
Does that hurt?
She asked, moving Skip's fingers to see if any were broken.
No,
he said, wincing.
What happened?
Like I said, I slid down a steep slope. What I really need is a shower.
All right.
Nora stood.
After you do that, I'm going to put some antibiotic ointment on those scrapes and bandage you up.
Fine.
Skip groaned as he eased himself from the sofa and limped into the bathroom. A moment later, she heard the water come on. The time was 6 o'clock. Was it too early to call Corey on a Monday morning? Probably not. She had a sense Corey was an early riser. She went to the sat phone and dialed. After several rings, she heard Corey's voice.
Hello?
Instantly, Nora could tell something was wrong.
Corey, are you okay?
After a long silence, Corey spoke.
Not really.
What's happening?
Another long pause.
Agent Morwood died in a fire.
What?
Another unsteady silence.
There was a fire in the forensics lab late Friday night. He was there for some reason. Killed by smoke inhalation.
Oh, Corey, I'm so sorry.
I'm still processing it.
What a shock. He was a good man. Do they know how the fire started?
They've launched an investigation. Everything seems to have gone wrong. The fire alarm didn't work. The sprinkler system failed. It's totally fucked up.
Her voice trailed off.
Are you going into work today?
Another long silence.
They tried to give me the week off, but I'm going in anyway.
She paused, then said,
I imagine there's a reason you called at 6 in the morning. I don't mean to burden you with my problems. What's up?
It's no burden. I had huge respect for Morwood. Nora hesitated, but decided to go ahead. It's true. We've got a little problem out at the dig site, and I was hoping to get your advice. But this obviously isn't a good time.
A good time?
Corey laughed hollowly.
It's the perfect time. I could use the distraction. The only way I'm going to get through this is if I bury myself in work.
Understood. Nora swallowed. One of our scientists went missing. He might be lost. He was way out in the middle of nowhere, wandering around in some hills, and he didn't return. We sent out search parties this morning, and maybe he'll turn up, but Tappan asked me to check with you to find out what to do if he doesn't.
Whereabouts did he disappear?
We think in an area called the Horse Heaven Hills, northwest of Dead Lake.
I have no idea where that is. Is it still in Chavez County?
I think so. Is this something the FBI would handle?
Only if it connects to the double homicide I'm working on, which seems unlikely. Because it's outside of a town jurisdiction, it would be handled by the county sheriff.
Who is that?
I've no idea. I can call Sheriff Watts and find out. It would probably be smart to loop him in anyway. He's in Socorro, a few counties to the west.
You want to report it right away, or wait until we're sure Baton's missing?
Best to report it ASAP, Corey said. If he turns up in a few hours, no harm done. Just to reassure you, the vast majority of missing persons cases get resolved within 24 hours when the person reappears. Let me contact Sheriff Watts and find out who you should deal with. I'll call you back.
Thank you, Corey. And again, I'm sorry to hear about Morwood.
Now I have something to do. Talk to you soon.
She hung up. The bathroom door opened and Skip appeared in a bathrobe, combing his hair. Now you don't look like a dirty, skinned cat, Nora said. Sit down and let me at those injuries. He sat down and she examined his nose again. He was going to have a black eye. The cuts and scrapes on his hands were, as he'd said, superficial. She smeared on antibiotic ointment and bandaged everything up.
Good as new. Thanks, sis.
He paused.
Guess I kind of messed up, didn't I?
What do you think?
Tappan is pissed.
Probably.
He might fire me.
Maybe.
I shouldn't have gone along with Baton and his secrecy. He was so sure of himself. Christ, I always manage to fuck things up.
He dropped his head into his hands. Nora suddenly felt sorry for him. Poor Skip. He was so impressionable, so easily led astray. It sounds like Baton suckered you in. Maybe Tappan will see that. If necessary, she could talk Tappan out of any really dire punishment. At this thought, her mind flashed back to the brief but wild interlude in his RV. She didn't ever want to use that as leverage.
Tappan's going to fire me for sure, he said,
too preoccupied to notice the flush that came over her face.
Look, Skip, the
They're going to find Baton. He'll apologize, and everything will go back to normal. What you said he figured out, that this is just a skip site, it actually makes perfect sense. I wish I'd thought of it. I'll bet Tappan will forgive him for going a little rogue. We'll have to find the real crash site now and start digging there.
I can't stop thinking about those lights I saw. I think they were in the area we'd been searching.
Maybe it was just a rancher looking for some lost horses. Maybe they were spies. Maybe Baton was a spy and he'd arranged to be picked up. In fact, I think that's probably the most likely.
Skip raised his head.
Baton? A spy?
It's possible.
Spying for who?
I don't know. She hesitated. Between you and me, Tappan suspects there's a spy on the team. Maybe it was Baton.
I don't think so.
Skip hesitated, then continued.
Baton told me a story about something that happened during his national service in the Israeli Defense Forces. I promised not to tell anyone.
Nora waited. She wasn't sure she wanted to hear it, whatever it was. God knows it might get Skip in deeper trouble. But after a moment, he went on anyway.
Baton was abducted by aliens.
You're joking.
No, I'm not. On Mount Hermon in Israel, the aliens communicated with him, gave him a mission, a destiny.
What kind of mission?
To prove intelligent extraterrestrials are watching us and waiting, that they have our best interests at heart, and that they have a plan for us. A good plan.
Nora stared at Skip. He was totally sincere. Okay, she said slowly. You really think what he said actually happened? Or is he maybe a little screwy? She was sure it was the latter, but wanted to know what Skip believed.
I know he believes it. That's beyond doubt. Look, he's one of the most distinguished astronomers in the world. The Wiseman Institute, Caltech, SETI. I mean, this guy is as solid as they come. He's no fantasist. If he says it really happened to him...
He let this observation hang in the air between them. Nora pondered this. Of course, the idea was absurd. If aliens wanted to announce their existence and reveal some plan for humanity, abducting a young man in Israel to deliver the news made no sense. But Skip was so serious, so earnest, she realized it was pointless to argue with him. She wondered if she should report this to Tappan. It didn't seem pertinent to Baton's disappearance and might create problems later, especially if Baton reappeared and found out Skip had divulged his secret.
I think, she said slowly, it would be best if you kept that story to yourself.
31. Corey sat at her desk, going over files she'd looked at half a dozen times already. Even though her meeting wasn't scheduled until 11, she'd come in at 8, determined that, if she wasn't going to take time off, she would put in full days, whether there were fires for her to put out or not. Fires. She winced, mentally kicking herself. Here she was, feeling annoyed that her progress was interrupted because the forensic lab was inaccessible, ignoring the fact this was because of a fire that killed her boss. After speaking to Garcia the day before, she'd done a reasonably good job of not dwelling on either Morwood's death or Lathrop's accusation. The early call she'd gotten this morning from Nora Kelly had helped in its own way. It gave her an excuse to phone Homer Watts, sheriff of Socorro County, to get his advice on the possible missing person. Excuse wasn't quite the right word, though. Despite being attracted to Watts, with his brown eyes, black hair, movie star looks, and Western rig, right down to the matching peacemakers, she'd hardly given the sheriff a thought over the last few months. He'd certainly been happy to get her call, though, and his dismay over Morwood's death was obviously sincere. When she explained why she was calling, he groaned. The sheriff of Chavez County was a good old boy named Buford. The name said it all, he'd told her. More adept at striding around in a uniform with jingling cuffs on his belt than he was at solving cases. Nevertheless, Watts had promised to call his fellow sheriff and give him the details if Corey agreed to meet him for breakfast tomorrow to catch up. Professionally, of course. Though she hadn't seen any need to catch up on anything, she'd agreed, secretly pleased by the invitation.
Hey, Corey.
The guy came by and dropped off her mail. There was a fat manila envelope in the stack, an FBI interagency delivered package. She grabbed it and tore it open. It was what she'd hoped, the report on the Crowns. She read through it with interest. The Crowns, the report noted, were made of an alloy called AISI-321, with stainless steel, nickel, and chromium, cast and machined with great precision. There was only one place where such fine dental work was done with this alloy, the Soviet Union, and in only one time period, 1939 to 1954. Corey sat back and pondered this unexpected finding. So the man with the Crowns was Soviet. Or, at the very least, he'd spent quite some time in the USSR. What was he doing in New Mexico in 1947? The answer to that wasn't exactly obscure. She glanced at her watch. Shit. 11 on the dot. She jumped up and raced out of her cubicle. If this senior agent was really willing to ghost her, even temporarily, the last thing she wanted to do was be late for their initial meeting. The door to Morwood's office, former office, was open, and she knocked on its metal frame.
"Come in," a baritone voice sounded.
Corey stepped inside. She was surprised to find the office looked about the same. Morwood's bric-a-brac was missing from the desk, and a few framed commendations had been removed from the walls, but all the furniture was in the same position. And neither the landscape paintings nor the shelves of books had been touched. This, along with her eagerness to meet Morwood's replacement, sent a stab of both guilt and grief through Corey's heart. She wasn't sure if this lack of change was due to the senior agent's recent arrival, out of respect for Morwood, or maybe both. But it drove home the fact that her mentor had been a very private person, and had never put much of himself on display. The new inhabitant of the office rose as she came in. She was struck by how young he looked in comparison to Morwood, then realized he had a kind of face that made it difficult to guess his age. He could have been 35 or a decade older. His suit, clean shave, and haircut were all FBI issue. But there was something about him. Maybe his friendly, unguarded smile, or the way that half a dozen open files were spread across his desk without false pretense of order, that reminded her of Agent Pendergast's insouciant disregard for red tape.
"You must be Agent Corinne Swanson," he said. "Very glad to meet you. Please, have a seat."
"Thank you, sir," she said. Unconsciously, she made for the chair she usually chose, then decided on the one next to it instead. "I wanted to thank you for agreeing..." He stopped her rush of words by raising his hands, imitating surrender.
"Please don't," he said. "For one thing, I'm not sure how long my case will keep me here, although it might be longer than expected. For another, you might find I'm an insufferable tyrant."
He smiled again, and she nodded, chancing a brief smile of her own. The relief she'd first felt at being given an interim mentor grew. Not only did this mean she was going to stay on track, career-wise, but her new mentor clearly understood the situation and seemed to be going out of his way to put her at ease.
"I'll tell you what,"
he continued, running a hand through his chestnut hair.
"This being our first meeting, I'll do most of the talking. Maybe let you relax a little. I can imagine you've had plenty on your mind this weekend."
"Thank you," she repeated, then quickly added,
Sir? First, though, I wanted to tell you how badly I feel about Hale Morwood's death. I know it must have hit you hard. I never met him personally, but he was well-respected among his peers, and he survived a couple of escapades early in his career that old-timers still like to recount. Maybe I can share one or two of them with you sometime.
I would welcome that, sir.
Probably the biggest favor I can do is to catch you up on the investigation of the fire. It's still in the early stages, of course. No accelerants were found. But then, it could hardly be arson in the FBI's own basement. Whatever caused it, the fire was fierce. I'm afraid there's not much left.
He paused.
As for Agent Morwood, the initial findings are death by asphyxiation. The ME will have a more complete report in a day or two, after the autopsy is complete. You're welcome to join me for his review, if that's something you'd care to do, of course.
Yes, sir, I would.
Maybe by then we'll have some sense of what he was doing in the building so late. Although, I understand he was a night owl by habit?
He raised his eyebrows, turning the statement into a question.
Yes, he was.
Good. Now, let's talk about what's been occupying your time.
He lifted a couple of folders from his desk, moving them around until he found what he was searching for.
The two unidentified bodies, shot and buried in the vicinity of Roswell. I've taken a glance over the file, but I'd rather get the details directly from you. After all, it's your case.
He smiled again, and his eyes twinkled just a little mischievously. Corey took a deep breath. Briefly, she laid out the facts of the case. They could be summed up in depressingly few sentences.
Thank you, he said when she finished. And your next steps?
Well, just this morning, I got the report back on the 4 stainless steel crowns.
At this, his eyebrows rose.
You'll have to forgive me. As I implied, I'm not yet up to speed on all the details.
They were from the male victim. Given their unusual nature, I had them sent off to Quantico for analysis. It turns out they were Soviet-made. The man was probably Russian, and, given the time and place, very likely a spy.
At this, he nodded slowly.
And?
If he was a mole, he was undoubtedly interested in the nuclear weapons program in the secret city of Los Alamos, which the Soviets knew all about in 1947. Most of those Soviet agents, I've been told, were based in Santa Fe.
Very interesting.
While it's a long shot, it might just be that dental records are still sitting in some dusty archive in Santa Fe that would help me ID the person. I plan to go to Santa Fe, if only because this is one of the very few bits of evidence we do have.
A good plan, he said.
Thank you, sir.
He put the file aside and leaned toward her slightly.
I would, of course, like to be kept in the loop. In fact, the best way to get me up to speed would be for you to assemble all the leads and evidence you've accumulated to date. Then we can decide together where we stand and how you should best move forward, given what's happened.
Corey, reminded again of the fire and Morwood's death, felt a stab of pain. Her new mentor must have guessed what she was thinking because he lowered his voice.
Listen to me, Agent Swanson. I've heard the imputation made against you, and I've also heard quite a bit about this guy Lathrop. You aren't accused of anything. You're not under investigation. For what it's worth, I think the fire investigation will clear you 100%. So I would suggest, I'll even make it an order, that you do not beat yourself up about all this.
He paused.
I've read Agent Morwood's reports about you, and Although he didn't say it in so many words, I got the sense he thought you the best rookie he ever ghosted.
This was so unexpected that it shattered all of Corey's defenses. Something inside her crumpled. It was all she could do to keep back the tears.
Thank you, sir, she said, fighting to maintain her composure.
Okay, so here's my second and last order for this meeting.
A faint smile now returned to his face.
Please don't call me sir. Agent Lime will do just fine. And I'll call you Swanson. Deal?
Deal,
Corey replied once she was confident she could keep the tremor from her voice.
Deal what?
Deal Agent Lime.
That's better. Thank you, Swanson. Now, go see what you can assemble for us to review.
And with that, he nodded his dismissal. Corey rose, left the office, and headed back to her desk. 32. Greg Banks, at the wheel of a Jeep, pulled up beside Tappan and the third Jeep, driven by Cecilia Toff. A cloud of white dust settled around them as they got out and stood looking across the flat white landscape to a range of hills beyond. It was frightening in its emptiness, Banks thought, but beautiful in spite of that. He had seen nothing like this before, outside the science fiction films he'd devoured as a kid.
This was Baton's rendezvous point, Tappan said, consulting his GPS. We'll start the search here.
The sun was well above the horizon, and the heat was coming up. A distant dust devil twisted across their field of view like a pale vertical snake.
Note the footprints, said Tappan.
It wasn't hard to see them in the light raking the soft alkali crust of the lake bed. One set went off to the left, the other to the right. As Banks scanned the vast, empty lake bed, he could see no sign of Baton.
Greg, said Tappan. You follow the left-hand tracks, and we'll follow the right. Cecilia, you go up the middle. We'll head to those hills.
They all climbed back into their respective vehicles. Banks eased the Jeep into drive and slowly cruised along the dry flats, the trail of prints he was following doubling back and forth in what was evidently a search pattern before it entered the first of the hills. He stopped the Jeep where the foothills rose. It was too rough to continue by vehicle. He got out to inspect the ground on foot, but it was impossible to see any tracks on the grassy slopes. His radio crackled.
Banks?
It was Tappan.
Let's proceed through the hills on foot, keeping a half-mile distance between us. Got it. Keep your GPS tracker on at all times.
Banks shrugged into his day pack, which contained water and lunch. As he trudged up the hill, his mind drifted to Baton and his eccentricities. He'd been suspicious of the bugger from the start. He wasn't sure why, but he always had the feeling Baton had some sort of hidden agenda. Also, there was a certain aloofness, or possibly a feeling of arrogance, about the astronomer that put him off. He arrived at the top of the first hill and scanned the landscape ahead with binoculars. 1,000 yards to his right, he could see somebody else doing the same. Somehow it felt even more like an alien landscape here, all these little hills crowded together, carpeted with tall grass waving in the wind, dotted with oaks as twisted as bonsai. The hills were separated by small ravines. This was the kind of a place where, if you had an accident and your body was lying at the bottom of one of those ravines, you might never be found. He caught movement out of the corner of his eye and quickly trained his binocs in that direction. A small herd of horses was cresting a hill and disappearing down the other side, moving fast, disturbed by the invasion of their domain. Horse Heaven Hills, an apt name, he thought as he made his way down the far side and continued on. He hiked northward, up and down the hills, sometimes following narrow horse trails. But he saw nothing except occasional horses, shy as deer, fleeing as soon as they spied him. After a few miles,
the hills petered out into a broad valley dotted with red sandstone buttes. This, he thought, must be Los Gigantes, the giant ones. Beyond that stood a range of foothills rising into mountains, purple in the late morning light. Banks took a break in the shade of an oak to drink water and eat a granola bar. It was a little crazy, he mused, the way he'd ended up in this place. It was all very sudden. He'd gotten the call just 3 weeks before in his South Kensington flat. Some woman on the phone saying that Lucas Tappan was on the line. At first, he thought it was a joke, one of his friends taking the piss. But when Tappan got on the phone, he quickly realized it was real. And then came the offer, the unbelievable compensation, and the demand that he drop everything. A week later, he was here, at the ends of the earth, preparing to excavate an alleged UAP crash site. Although he had long believed UAPs were real, he had serious doubts about the Roswell site. All those doubts, however, vanished when the mass spectra had come in, revealing an unknown super-heavy element present in trace amounts. That floored him like nothing else had in his life. He'd gone over it 100 times, and there was no way of getting around the evidence. It was a smoking gun, proof that an intelligently engineered, extraterrestrial object made of exotic compounds had indeed crashed at the site. The full significance was still sinking in. Clearly, this discovery was going to change his life, but exactly how, he couldn't yet predict. Other implications, too, were inescapable. That the U.S. government had indeed found a UAP at Roswell and covered it up. What had happened in the 70 years since? Had the bloody government been reverse-engineering the technology? Had they been in contact with the ETs? How would they react to having their long deception uncovered? He felt himself sailing into uncharted waters. And then there was Tappan, who insisted they keep the super-heavy element discovery under wraps. He wondered why. His radio crackled, Tappan again.
Greg, any signs?
Nothing.
Let's continue into the valley with the buttes and reconnoiter there.
Tappan sent a GPS coordinate specifying where they should meet.
Got it.
He finished the granola bar, took another gulp of water, and continued hiking into the valley. He wondered again what could have happened to Baton. The man had grown up in the Negev, so it wasn't as if he was ignorant of a desert environment. It would be hard to get lost. Even if his GPS had died, all he'd had to do was climb a hill and look around to determine which direction to go. While he might have had a fall or been bitten by a snake, Banks thought it more likely Baton had engineered his own disappearance. The lights Skip had seen hinted that someone might have met him out here and picked him up. Although, if that was the case, why hadn't they seen any tire tracks? The valley he was hiking in was a dramatic place, with the great buttes of sandstone rising hundreds of feet. There was no shade anywhere. 3 hours later, they were back at their jeeps, having found no trace of Baton beyond the lake bed, no footprints or other evidence of human presence. At 1 p.m., after 7 hours of fruitless searching, to Banks's relief, Tappan called it a day, and they headed back to camp. 33. At 5 o'clock, Nora entered Quonset 1, her brother reluctantly in tow, for a meeting called by Tappan. Skip hadn't wanted to come. He was embarrassed and afraid he'd be fired. But Nora had persuaded him it would be worse if he stayed away. All the scientific staff was there. They took seats around a large conference table at the back of the building. Tappan was the last to arrive, striding in at 5 minutes past, heading directly to the head of the table. Instead of sitting, he placed his hands upon the back of the chair and passed his gaze over the troubled group.
"Well," he finally said, "as you all know, we weren't able to find Gnome Baton. We aren't sure if the disappearance was intentional or accidental. Naturally, we're concerned,
and it's been reported to both the FBI and the county sheriff.
He glanced around again.
It turns out, as most of you now know, that Dr. Baton had discovered something of great significance to our project. A discovery that may explain his disappearance.
Yet again, his gaze swept the room, this time coming to rest on Skip.
He took his assistant, Skip Kelly, into his confidence. I'm going to ask Skip to now share that confidence with us.
Nora glanced over and saw pure panic on Skip's face.
Me?
He stammered.
Yes, you.
Tappan drilled him with his eyes.
I can understand why you felt compelled to keep that information from the rest of the team, but now the time has come for you to share it with everyone. We need to hear it from your own lips.
Yes, sir, said Skip. I'm really sorry. I realize I've let down the team.
Tappan waved his hand.
Please stand up so everyone can see you.
Skip got to his feet, nervously smoothing down his hair.
Well, as I mentioned earlier to some of you, Baton decided, his observations and calculations indicated that this site, the traditional Roswell site, was not where the UAP crashed. He believed the spaceship came in at such a shallow angle that it basically skipped off the ground, went airborne again, and crashed somewhere else. His calculations indicated where it might have landed. We were looking for that place when he disappeared.
I assume you didn't find it?
Asked Tappan.
No.
Thank you, Skip. Is there anything more?
Nora saw Skip hesitate.
No, that's all.
He sat down, his face covered in a sheen of perspiration. She was glad he hadn't gone on to share Baton's story of alien abduction.
The three engineers have gone over Baton's calculations,
Tappan said.
They've confirmed he was right. The UAP did indeed skip off the ground and keep going. What's more, the idea that this is a skip site is consistent with Nora's excavation of the groove, or trough, and its lack of substantial evidence. And this afternoon, Greg Banks did refined calculations of the UAP's possible trajectory. Greg?
Banks rose, holding a sheaf of papers.
We reran Baton's calculations using computer modeling of the presumed shape, speed, and angle of the object, along with its mass, air resistance, and so forth. Obviously, we're lacking quite a few data points, but the model indicates Baton was somewhat off in his calculations of where the thing might have landed. We believe its trajectory would have taken it farther, beyond the hills. It probably would have landed somewhere in the vicinity of the Los Gigantes Buttes, or in the foothills of the mountains beyond.
How certain are you?
Tappan asked.
About 80%, within the elliptical area we've outlined on our map. That's the area being overflown with the LIDAR plane as we speak.
Thank you. And now Vitaly will cover that. Vitaly?
Kuznetsov rose, smoothing down his hair.
Once we had Greg's calculations, we called in a LIDAR survey of the area. Fortunately, both aircraft and pilot were available at the last minute. For a price, of course. The plane flew up from Albuquerque around 4, and as Greg just mentioned, should be on site around now. It'll take about 3 hours to scan the 5-square-mile target area. We should have the data processed by tomorrow morning. There is a little bit of a twist, however.
What's that? Tappan asked.
There's an area in the eastern part of the Los Fuertes Mountains where the airspace is closed. It's quite a ways outside the projected landing area, so I don't think it will impede our discovery of the true crash site,
but our pilot is having to fly a rather circuitous route to avoid that airspace.
Closed? Tappan asked sharply.
Why?
It's not as significant as you might think. About 30% of the airspace over New Mexico is closed to civilian overflights, for many reasons. Holloman AFB, White Sands Missile Range, large areas over Los Alamos and the Sandia Mountains, where nuclear weapons are designed and stored. It's basically a patchwork.
Tappan eased back.
I see. Thank you, Vitali. Excellent and efficient work, all of you. If this LIDAR survey pans out, tomorrow we'll move our base of operations to the new crash site. Not the entire camp, of course. That's too complicated. But the excavation team. I've already spoken to Nora about this, and she's on board. We have the heavy equipment necessary to grade a road, so we can essentially commute back and forth from what will become a base camp, here, to the new dig site. It's all government land, so it's still covered by our permits.
Another sweeping gaze over the room.
Any questions?
There was a general murmur, and Nora could sense the undercurrent of fresh enthusiasm and excitement.
Do you think it might still be there?
Toth asked.
That maybe the government didn't find it after all?
It's a possibility, Tappan said slowly. What about Bataan?
Emilio Vigil asked.
What are we supposed to do about his disappearance? We've done all we can and reported it to the relevant authorities. The problem is now in the hands of the professionals. We'll cooperate with them. But in the meantime, we need to move forward full speed with our own project and leave the search to them.
He paused and said, his voice lower,
Earlier, I said it wasn't clear whether or not this development was an accident. But it's my opinion Bataan may have disappeared as part of a premeditated plan.
Why?
Vigil asked.
Who knows? He was keeping secrets. He suborned a member of our staff. I don't take kindly to that.
His gaze turned to Skip, who turned red.
Skip, however, is contrite. He's leveled with us. And up to this point, he's proven a valuable member of the team. So I've decided to keep him on the project. But I won't tolerate any more secrets. I hope that's understood.
He checked his watch.
6 o'clock. That's happy hour for me. If there are no further questions, see you all tomorrow.
As everyone was filing out, he paused to touch Nora on the shoulder.
Nora, could I see you for a moment in my RV? I want to review plans for moving the excavation.
She tamped down on the acceleration of her heart. Fine. As they walked to his trailer, she said,
About Skip, I just want to thank you for understanding.
He again placed a hand on her shoulder.
No worries about Skip. I told you my suspicions about a mole, and this abrupt disappearance seems like damning evidence to me. Skip fell under Bataan's spell, and that's forgivable. Besides, he's your brother, and...
His voice trailed off. He opened the door for her, ushered her in, closed it behind them, then, his breath husky, pressed her against it, raised her thighs with surprisingly strong arms, and wrapped them tightly around his waist.
34.
At the safe house he'd been assigned, a well-furnished condominium in the quiet Quaker Heights neighborhood of Albuquerque, Agent Lime looked out the living room windows, gazing with apparent disinterest at the dark, sleepy street. After a moment, he closed the curtains, then lowered an inner set of blinds specially fabricated to give off a false heat signature, as well as to block Havana Syndrome microwaves or signals from Stingray IMS eye-catching devices. He walked over to a spare wood-topped desk, sat down, and unlocked the bottom drawer via a hidden thumbprint analyzer. The drawer, lined with a nitrocellulose accelerant that would destroy the contents if any tampering was detected, popped open. Among other things, it revealed 5 identical phones, arranged in a careful row, and a small lead-lined box. Taking out the box, Lime opened it and removed a 1-time SIM card. He slid the card into the flank of the leftmost phone, put the box back in the drawer, and closed it. The phone was small and without any identifying features. In many ways, it was dumb, lacking onboard GPS and other features common in recent years. This was by design. In one way, however, it was highly specialized. It used classified technology to bounce an encrypted signal off a network of spy satellites rather than relying on cell towers. He looked at his watch, waiting for the seconds to tick off until it was exactly 7:05. Then he entered some numbers, waited, tapped in his authentication, then entered another, shorter set of numbers. After a series of clicks, the familiar voice came on the line.
Servande vite mendacium, nemini digeris, said Lime, giving the countersign.
I'll take your report now, Colonel Rush said.
Per his training, Lime wasted no words.
My insertion was timely. Agent Swanson has made more progress than expected on Hostile Interdiction 3. Despite the fire, she has aggressively followed up on the remaining evidence.
Could this lead to further progress?
That remains to be seen.
Don't you think termination would be a wise precaution?
With all respect, sir, it might be a little early for that. Swanson is the suspicious type, and may be salting her evidentiary trail. We don't want to skin the rabbit unless we're sure no scat's been left behind.
A colorful expression. Did you pick it up out there?
This morning, sir.
I'll remember it. And you're confident leaving her in place is the right way to proceed?
Yes. I've eliminated the biggest, most immediate threat. If something happens to Swanson directly on the heels of that, it will raise questions. In my opinion, sir, the ongoing dig is far more dangerous.
He paused.
May I ask how the debriefing is proceeding?
It's reached its termination. No further information of use was extracted. He hadn't identified the location of Alpha, although he did discover that Beta was merely the ricochet location. Their team is currently searching for Alpha.
If the group discovers, well, sir, you know my concerns about the initial extraction being insufficiently thorough.
It's not our place to question the actions of those who came before us.
I'd never do that, said Lime.
And you do understand the reasons why no further extraction or exploration was undertaken, or can be undertaken in the foreseeable future, at Alpha.
Yes, but that doesn't negate the possibility of...
Lime's voice trailed off, and his superior completed the sentence.
Contact.
Yes, sir.
Duly noted.
I want to assure you that I will keep my foot on the throat of Swanson's inquiries, and if it becomes necessary, escalate with prejudice.
Very good. If that's all, we'll talk again tomorrow at the scheduled time, unless an alert arises before that.
Thank you, sir,
Lime replied. 2 additional clicks, then the line went dead. Lime sat for a moment, mentally reviewing the conversation and whether it called for any restructuring of his plans. Deciding it did not, he took the SIM card from the phone, then turned toward an unusual device resembling a small oil drum. Topped with a cylindrical steel cap, tethered to the drum by a flexible pipe of metal mesh. Swinging open the cap, he dropped the chip of silicon in, then closed it again. The faintest whump sounded within as the barrel cyclone incinerated the SIM card. Next, Lime looked at the phone, mentally counting the number of times it had been used. 5. Despite its resistance to high-tech infiltration, Tradecraft nevertheless dictated it was time to switch it out for another. The whump the phone made as it was flash incinerated was louder, but still nothing above a footfall, and in no way disturbed the somnolence of the evening. 35. Corey looked up from her desk, eyes fastening on the pyramid clock hung above the exit to the elevator banks. 7:45? It didn't seem possible. She'd been at her desk since meeting with Lime, putting together a timeline of the investigation all the way from Nora's initial call to her conversation with Sheriff Watts that morning. Wherever she could, she cross-referenced the details with database links to photographs, digital DNA samples, measurements for the facial reconstructions, ballistic tests, and all the other flotsam and jetsam that attach themselves to an investigation like iron filings to a magnet. She'd felt oddly satisfied upon completion. Despite what was almost certainly lost in the fire, and no matter where the case led from here, she felt she'd outlined a solid foundation for Lime of the investigation to date. Equally satisfying and unexpected was the number of people who had come up to her over the course of the afternoon to express their sympathy and support. Most were junior agents, including, surprisingly, a couple of the macho types who'd been standoffish when she first arrived. A few senior agents, who wouldn't normally have given her the time of day, had also paused at her cubicle to casually nod or greet her. Although no specifics were mentioned, Corey understood. Word of Lathrop's accusation had gotten around, and the consensus seemed to be that the man was full of shit. Corey knew the forensic pathologist wasn't popular. Perhaps that was influencing people's opinions. One thing, however, she wouldn't forget. Lime, her new mentor, had been the first to voice uncompromising support for her. She began tidying up her cubicle in preparation for leaving. Despite the lingering shock and grief, she found herself curious about Agent Lime. She'd listened in on some of the water cooler gossip earlier that afternoon, and it seemed his background was almost as mysterious as Morwood's had been. Only one agent on the floor had worked with him before, quite a while back, and had not gotten to know him well. That in itself was no big surprise. She knew that some agents liked to keep their CVs to themselves, especially if they didn't have all that stellar a history. And she'd overheard one person sniggering about Lime's luck. 2 years riding a desk in D.C., and here he was, being rewarded by ghosting recruits. The Schadenfreudian tone of this observation had surprised her. Perhaps Lime felt like an outsider in Albuquerque. That made two of them. Cubicle in order, she turned to power down her computer. On the screen was a memo she'd received about the DNA results. There were no hits in any database, not even in the giant commercial genetic testing databases the FBI had access to. That was true of both autosomal and mitochondrial DNA, which was truly odd. These two people had to be related to somebody, somewhere. She made a mental note to have that rechecked. She stood up, threaded her way out of the cube maze, and, bypassing the elevators, took the stairs down one level to the main entrance. By now it was nearly 8:15, but she was glad of the late hour. The less time alone with her thoughts, the better. As she approached the security barrier, she saw Shady the guard settling in behind his command station, preparing for the night shift. Shady was a rotund, affable ex-cop with a pale, moon-like face and a head as bald as a cue ball, who insisted that everyone call him by the mysterious nickname nobody seemed to know the origin of. He was one of the friendliest people in the place, and Corey always felt a rush of affection when she saw him. "Hi, Shady," Corey said as she came up to the barrier.
"Well, hello there, Ms. Swanson."
Shady never called anybody agent. It was either Mr., Ms., Sir, or Ma'am. She smiled and, taking a pen from her purse, started filling out the pass required of all agents exiting or entering outside normal hours. Swanson C, SA, GS 111, Section 2G.
"Hey, Miss Swanson,"
Shady said in an uncharacteristically serious tone.
"I wanted to say that I was very sorry about Mr. Morwood."
"Thank you," Corey said as she added her signature.
"He was a straight-up guy. A lot of people rush in and out of here like their behinds were afire. Excuse the expression. But Mr. Morwood, he'd stop to talk, ask how you were. Hell, he'd even listen to my stories from time to time."
Shady chuckled. Corey looked up at Shady. He was an old-time beat cop, all right, even down to his sidearm, a well-worn Colt detective special. She wondered who he had at home, if anyone. It probably got lonely here, too. Long nights with precious little to break the monotony. Maybe he was just a natural nighthawk.
"See you later," she said, pushing the off-hours pass through the security screen.
"Have a nice evening,"
Shady replied, taking the pass. Then he frowned. Corey was not letting go of the pass. She was thinking.
"Miss Swanson?" Shady asked.
Corey lifted her fingers from the counter, releasing the pass.
"Sorry, I was distracted."
She hesitated.
"Shady, I wonder if you could help me with a question."
"Be glad to."
"When did Agent Morwood usually leave in the evenings?"
She knew he often worked late, but she'd never kept close track.
"Well, you know, there was no rhyme or reason to that. Not as far as I can tell, anyway. Here, I'll give you an example."
Shady turned to his screen and began tapping the keyboard with his index fingers.
"This last week, for instance. Monday, he clocked out at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, 8:20. Wednesday, 9:05. Thursday, 5:45. Friday, 5 o'clock. See what I mean?"
"Yes, I do."
No rhyme or reason, indeed. Corey wasn't even sure why she'd asked the question. Something was prompting her to pick up every crumb, turn over every leaf of his final days on Earth. Somehow, she'd begun to sense that Morwood was holding something back in those last days. But what it might be, or if it was only her imagination, she couldn't begin to fathom.
"Thanks a lot, Shady,"
she said as she turned away.
"My privilege, miss. Enjoy the rest of the evening."
Corey passed through the barrier, then started down the steps, rooting in her bag for her keys. It was only when she reached the bottom step that she abruptly stopped.